Okay, Boker Tov, Versay Seit Sarayim Tovim. We can start. I have the honor of broadcasting from Yerushalayim, where I've been spending the last, I guess I got here Monday night on a 3-day solidarity mission, which is basically that's who comes to Israel these days. These missions, they basically all follow the same, more or less. You know, they spend a day in Jerusalem, a day in the Gaza envelope, like where we were, as in Kfar Aza on Wednesday and Shderot, and it's a lot to talk about, but that's not the time, I don't think. And day in Tel Aviv, and it's very powerful. The people in Israel are really amazing and really strong. I think there is, you know, everything you read about the sense of unity and people, basically it's the Golda Meir line. We have no choice. If Israel doesn't win this war decisively, there will be no state of Israel. That's sort of the feeling. In other words, they will not be able to live here if Hamas is still in power when this ends. And the determination is amazing, but what's even more amazing is the confidence of the people. And it's tough, but what can I say? I mean, I'm American, Canada, you know. But anyways, met a lot of fascinating people and whatever, parents who lost, you know, children and people who save people, and you know, an analyst and the president. We had a meeting with President Herzog, and very honored and whatever. Okay, I'm happy to talk about it another time, but let's get into our learning. And listen, I will say, if you can come, it's worthwhile coming. I mean, our cab driver this morning thanked us for giving him parnassa for his day, because there's no, you know, half the restaurants are closed and there's nobody, you know. People aren't here. And so business and the hundreds of thousands of people in the army, they're slowly releasing some. It really has an impact on the economy. So just for the economic benefits, I don't know how much money I'm spending, but, you know, a little bit, all of us add to the economy. Okay. Because we're giving the shiur an hour early, I decided it's not really fair to go on the sitter. So we'll take a break. And for those who remember, 10-point bonus we did part one of the 630 mitzvah when I was in Portugal in the summer. So does anybody remember what we spoke about? Was anybody there? I can just, you know, give the same shiur. Would anybody notice? You probably would notice, but okay, so I'll very briefly. I think this is the topic of the 613 mitzvah, Tariq mitzvah, is a fascinating topic. So I'll give like a very brief review of what we discussed back in June. And that's basically that there's no consensus about what the 613 mitzvot are. There is no list that people agree upon. There are lists, but the lists vary. The Bahag's list, that's the first one, the 8th century, the first list, and that list includes Megillat Esther and Netilat Yadayim, which are a rabbinic mitzvot. It's very strange, included in the 600, and we assume the 613 mitzvot are biblical. Nonetheless, he includes, you know, 7 rabbinic mitzvot. The Rambam didn't like that too much, and that's a huge understatement. And he wrote his list, and the problem is that there are 5 million mitzvot. What are 613 mitzvot? There's a million things we have to do. So he had to give you 14 limiting categories. That the most important limiting category, that anything that is not directly in the text is not a mitzvah. In other words, 98% of Judaism is not considered one of the Tariyag mitzvot. In other words, to keep Shabbos. Okay, so there's a mitzvah to keep Shabbos. How to keep Shabbos, that's not in the Torah anywhere. The 39 categories of work are nowhere to be found in the Torah. So none of those are considered biblical mitzvot. Mm-hmm. Most of what we do in Jewish life is not written in the Torah. It's one of the 13, that's the most famous one, the 13 principles of Rabbi Yishmael. And the Kal Vachomer, Gzeirah Shavah, exactly, by reading between the lines of the text is very nice. And maybe that's more important. You read between the lines of Shakespeare too. And it's not that but it's not a biblical mitzvah. It's not one of the Taryag mitzvah. I should rephrase that. It may be a biblical mitzvot, but it doesn't count as one of the 630 mitzvot. And then I discussed, who cares? Like, what's the difference? If we assume there are 39 biblical prohibited activities on Shabbos, and theoretically, one gets a death penalty if one cooks on Shabbos. Doesn't say anywhere in the Torah you can't cook on Shabbos. So it is a biblical mitzvah. So who cares if it's one of the 613 mitzvot? So I explained that, though I've asked this question to many people, and everybody, they never thought of that question. It's an interesting question. So I have an answer. I then tell them my answer. Oh, well, that's an interesting answer. Whether it's right or not is different story, but I assume it is right. Because it's based on, it's not just I made it up. It's based on things, on sources that, basically, any drasha can change. That the 39 melachot that was made by the rabbis at a certain period in history, they decided or they declared what are the melachot, and there are debates about all these things. And most of the drashot we have, there are debates, and we may accept a certain halachic type of position, but that can change. Now, the problem is, and the reason we find this strange, because we today can't change it for the last 1800 years. Let's say from the time of the Mishnah. That's other question, maybe from the time of the Gemara. At some point in the, at least 1500 years ago, we no longer have the ability to undo and to change a drasha and say, no. We don't think we should learn the laws of Shabbat from the Mishkan. We think we should learn it another way. And there are going to be 24 prohibitions or 68 prohibitions or, and really cooking is allowed on Shabbat. So I know that sounds insanely radical, but that's really, that's classical Judaism. How a Sanhedrin, that's what a Sanhedrin is. That's what it means to have a Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin, just like Lahavdil, the Supreme Court reinterprets and the abortion used to be allowed for 50 years. Now the Supreme Court said it isn't. What changed? So, okay, I'm you don't have to answer the abortion part, but you get the idea. Things change all the time. So courts review rulings. And this Rav Schechter, who I met in Kfar Aza, Rav Schechter, I always quote him, my Rebbe for 4 years, I bumped into him, if I can use that word. He was in Kfar Aza the same time we were. I mean, unbeknownst to either of us, whatever. But what is it? So he often says that Judaism does not rule on precedent, whereas American law, very often, you know, a judge will say in the 1927, you know, Evans versus Seventh Circuit Court, whatever, and the ruling, and they cite that as a precedent. And Rav Schechter would always tell us Judaism doesn't believe in precedent. Mm-hmm. Not that it's wrong or we have to ignore it, just we're allowed to ignore it. Yeah, it's the Chatam Sofer said something, we should take it into consideration. But as I've mentioned, the number of times, Rav Moshe Feinstein, his introduction to the Igrot Moshe is how he's going to disagree with people who he considers greater than himself. So he's not saying I'm as great as the Nota Biyuda or the Chatham Sofer, but I, in my generation, I'm the leading rabbi. He sort of understood that. He was very modest, but being modest knows, yeah, he didn't say that he's the greatest rabbi, but said that he's entitled to an opinion, and I'm saying he was the greatest, posek. Of the time, so he's allowed to reinterpret, to review laws. So we can even do that on a biblical level if we had a Sanhedrin, and that's why there were two major attempts in Jewish history to recreate a Sanhedrin. The first major attempt was after the Spanish expulsion, and that's Rav Yosef Karo was one of the seven people who got smicha. Rav Yaakov Beirav gave him smicha, and that's why he wrote the Shulchan Aruch. That's one of the main reasons the Shulchan Aruch was going to be the constitution of this newly created Sanhedrin, and that fizzled out. That's for another discussion. And then, of course, in 1948, there was an attempt. I remember, I don't know if I mentioned this before, the first shiur I ever heard Rav Aaron Lichtenstein give. I was in the Kurs Kolel and Smich at YU. I didn't go to Gush. I was in Yeshiva Akoto. Maybe I heard him when I was in Gush. I actually, in Yeshiva, I did on a Friday night, but I never heard him give a Gemara shiur until I was in the Kurs Kolel. And we were learning Sanhedrin that year. And his first shiur was on how to define Eretz Yisrael. Well, what's the definition of Eretz Yisrael? Why? Because there's a halacha that you can only give smicha, you can only give rabbinic ordination in the land of Israel. And he said, are there different definitions for the land of Israel? For Truma and Maser, maybe it's a different definition. And as part of that shiur, he made us known of the book of Yehuda Lev Maimon. People know who Yehuda Lev Maimon is? Anybody know who Yehuda Lev Maimon is? Nobody knows. Okay.
Was he a genius who was he a genius who got married at 13? Is that possible?
It is possible, but I don't know. He's not, he's in history not known as a great, you know, Well, he was obviously a serious Talmid Chacham, but he himself didn't regard
One of the founders of Mizrahi, like very involved.
Yeah, I don't know if he was the founder of Mizrahi, right. But he was correct. He was the first minister of religion, I believe.
That's not who I'm thinking of. Never mind.
He would have liked Maimon, the Moser Rav Kook has a whole thing about him. He was a tons of book. He wrote this 6-volume, fascinating. If you have nothing, like one summer, you want to relax. I don't think it's translated English. Sarei Hameya. The Princes of the Hundred. This is from 1840 to 1940. No, the Hebrew dates, the century ends at, 1240, 1340. We're 240 years difference between the English and the Hebrew. They were, what are we, 5784, and we're 2024 now. The 240 years, forget the thousands. So he wrote Sarei HaMeah about the great rabbis who lived between 1840 and 1940, many of whom he met. He was obviously a very friendly, he would make himself, he would meet all these rabbis and he wrote all the stories. It's very fascinating, very atypical. But he wrote a book that Rav Lichtenstein mentioned, Hitchatshut HaSanhedrin Bizman Hazeh, the renewal of the Sanhedrin in our time. I have it at home, I bought it, and it's 75 pages. Basically, it's a plea to the rabbis, to Gedolim. He didn't consider himself on that level. The true leader, Rav Herzog, whose grandson, we met yesterday, the president of Israel, Rav Herzog was the Gaon Shebegonim. People don't realize Rav Elyashiv used to go to the Shirim of Rav Herzog. I told you many times the Nechama Leibowitz story, right? Everybody remember? Do I have to say it over, the Nechama Leibowitz story of Rav Herzog? Zeb?
Sure, say it over. Say it over.
I should say it over. Oh my gosh. Okay. The Chama Leibowitz told us she went to ask Rav Herzog once where the source of something was. She didn't know where it was. So she went to Rav Herzog and she asked Rav Herzog, and Rav Herzog went like this. Bebavli ze lo nimtza. It's not in the Babylonian Talmud. It's not in the Babylonian Talmud. And then Rav Herzog told her, I cannot do that with if I remember correctly, with the Talmud Yerushalmi, he can't do that. He refers to, I can't go through the Talmud Yerushalmi like this. But the Talmud Bavli, he could go through like this. The Bavli is alone himself. That reminds me, of course, they have the other story when Rav Chaim, Rav Zevin quotes the story, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, a different method of learning. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, somebody once quoted something, a Tosfot to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. So Rav Chaim said, that's not in Tosfot. Tosfot doesn't say that. So the person asked Rav Chaim, do you know every Tosfot that you know? So Rav Chaim says, no, I don't. But I know Tosfot well enough to know he could never say such a thing. That's a very different style. That's the Brisker style analysis. But then there's the Bekiyu style, where just, put a pin in the Talmud. And, everywhere, different styles of learning. Anyways, so that people like Rav Herzog, people on that level, should recreate a Sanhedrin. That was the book, and it's based on a Rambam. I mean, it's not you made it up. The Rambam writes, Yireli, the Rambam opens up the possibility of reinstituting a Sanhedrin. And if and when that happens, first of all, that'll be a wonderful thing. You should know at the time everybody was opposed to it. Obviously the more conservative, small C conservative religious groups are going to be opposed to this. This is too radical. Who do you think you are, recreating a Sanhedrin? And obviously the non-religious Jews don't want that, to have a Supreme Court of Jewish law. That's ridiculous. So nobody wanted it. And that was the time, I think, the Brisker Rav put Heichal Shalom with the Cherem. Whenever it is what it is. By the way, the fight in the 1500s and 16th century Sfat was bitter, 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 bitter a few more times. In other words, the debate over the reinstitution of Smicha was horrific and, like the judicial reform debate, but probably worse. In other words, they didn't have hundreds of thousands of people, but the language and the vitriol that the rabbis in each side expressed towards one each other was horrific. It was like, the future of the Jewish people. Like it was a judicial reform debate. It was exactly the same idea, but just halachically, if you're interested in the subject, Jacob Katz has written a fair bit about it. I don't know if it's been translated into English. But anyway, so that's, so getting back to 630 minutes, why it's all important. So if we have a Sanhedrin, the Sanhedrin will decide, I always say, I hope they don't decide this, but a lot of people hope the Sanhedrin will decide no more 2 days Yontif in Israel, outside of Israel. They'll decide all kinds of things because they'll have the, authority. So but the 613 mitzvot, that can never change. written in the biblical text. So that's what makes something a mitzvah. If it's written, that's God's divine eternal word. God's divine eternal word we can never change. The rabbinic understanding how to read God's words, how to translate it into our life and read between the lines, that can change. Different rabbis who will read it in different ways in different times. But we don't have the ability. But that, I think, is the core difference. That's why it's important. For us, practically, it makes no difference if it's really one of Taryak Mitzvot or not. It's a mitzvah. I mean, sometimes there is an argument of it is a mitzvah, it isn't a mitzvah, like living in Israel. The Rambam seems to claim there is no obligation to live in Israel. It's a nice thing to do, but there's no obligatory mitzvah to live in Israel. The Rambam strongly disagrees, and he says there is an important mitzvah to live in Israel. Whatever it is, there are many debates. So we don't have a list, but anyways, that's, I think, I don't know if I said all of this back in June, but I said some of this. Okay, let's move on. I said, the last thing I have in my notes is how drasha can change. I said, this is where I got up to. So now we can start afterwards. Okay, so the Rambam, you know, in his introduction to each set of laws in the Mishnah Torah always tells you how many mitzvot there are. So he'll tell you, like, I think there are 5 mitzvot on Shabbat and there are 51 about Avodah Zarah. 51, that's like, I don't know, 8% of the Torah mitzvot is about idolatry. We don't relate to these mitzvot. Like, they're not like, you know, we don't really go there. Doesn't impact on us so much. But, and he writes in how many mitzvot there are. And that's what some people claim that and it's clearly what the Rambam is doing in the Mishnah Torah is explaining what the 613 mitzvot is. His Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of Mitzvot, which is the introduction to the Mishnah Torah, is the book to explain how do we get to 613 mitzvot. So he gives you the 14 principles. The rabbinic law, that's number one. And number two, what I said, if it's a drasha, it's not included. If it's not permanent, there are lots of things in the Torah, let's say on Pesach, that was meant for the generation that left Egypt. That doesn't apply to us. Sometimes it's not so easy to tell if it's just meant for one generation or not. But if you assume something is meant for only one generation, as a matter of fact, the Megillat Esther, not the Purim Megillat Esther, Megillat Esther, from Moshe de Leon. I don't know if it's Moshe de Leon. I think it's de Leon. Miguel S. is one of the commentators on Sefer Mitzvot. He's a very famous comment. It's the only thing, well, people like me who can't go like this, but Bavli Zalominza, I know one thing about the Megillat Esther. That's what most people know. The one thing that made the Megillat Esther famous, the Megillat Esther defended the Rambam from the attacks of the Rambam. The Rambam would often attack the Rambam. You're wrong, you know. On 31 Mitzvot, they disagree, like, living in Israel. So the Megillat Esther always comes to the defense of the Rambam. We always have people like that. Like the Ramban comes to the defense of the Rif. You know, there are always people who attack and then there are people who defend. Even if they don't necessarily believe in the defense, but they offer a defense. I don't really think defense is right, but you could understand why the Rambam said this, even though I don't think he is correct in what he said. So the Megillat Esther defends the Rambam. Why isn't living in Israel a mitzvah? Like the Ramban has all these proofs it's a mitzvah. So what's the defense of the Megillat Esther? Anybody know? It's basically Satmar. That's the defense. It was before Satmar. But the defense is that the mitzvah of Israel was only a temporary mitzvah. When we were exiled in the year 70, the mitzvah stopped applying. How do we know the mitzvah stopped applying? Because the Gemara has this idea that when we were in exile, God made us take 3 oaths. We had to swear that we're not going to go up to Israel against the will of the nations. We're not going to go up in mass. Nations won't subjugate us. And that Gimel Shvuot, which is the ideology of Satmar. Yeah, it's the Satmar ideology, basically. Not basically, exactly. That's the Satmar ideology, that it's not only is it not a mitzvah, it's prohibited. What do you mean it's not a mitzvah? It's prohibited to set up a state before Yimon HaMashiach, and therefore there's no mitzvah to live in Israel. It's almost a prohibition. An individual is allowed to live in Israel, but you're not allowed to send a community. I don't know exactly where the break is, but I assume Petach Tikva, I think that was the first one of the settlements, it's prohibited. You're not allowed to set it up. The Gemara and Ksuvas, the Gemara, I'm not making this. The Halakha Gemara, the Gimel Shvuot. So there are many answers. The Gimel Shvuot is not accepted. The Gimel Shvuot was popular until the Holocaust. And until the Holocaust, most rabbis, that was always the view. We wait for the Messiah. Hitler changed that. But Satmar was in the majority. Now they became in the minority. They're the only ones holding up the true Torah path. Everybody else reformed and went terrible things, and you know, a new Sanhedrin, whatever. And we hold on to the old ways of the Gemara. No Jewish state, God forbid, until the coming of the Messiah. So that's what the Megillat Esther. He doesn't obviously it's led without the political baggage. But the Megillat Esther explains that's why the Rambam doesn't count living in Israel as a mitzvah. Which it's not like it's not like you can't cook on Shabbos. It's not counted, but it's a biblical prohibition, even though it's not counted. No, living in Israel is not only is it not counted, it's not a mitzvah. Like it's bad to go on Aliyah with the Karina. Now, obviously, that's not the view. I think anybody who's in this class, who accepts that view probably shouldn't be here. You know, I don't think this is the right place for you if that's what you believe, because obviously that comes with other beliefs that we very much don't hold by, at least here. Okay, anyway, so that's, but the mitzvah of Talmud Torah is really, as the Rambam was saying, is a mitzvah to learn what the 613 mitzvot are. Why? So this I heard from Rav Schachter many years ago, and what is it, you know, if I'd ask you what type of book is it? This is actually a fascinating discussion. Menachem Liebtag does this every once in a while. What type of book is the Torah? If you're going to the library, you go to, I don't want to say Harvard anymore. I don't know what universities are left. University of Maryland, I don't know. You go to some nice part of university. I haven't heard of it, what the anti-Semitism is like there. So you go to the library, University of Maryland, or NYU, whatever. Actually, I'll say Yale University, because a friend of mine is friends with the president of Yale. They were in Yale together. The president of Yale is actually a Soloveitchik. I don't know if people know that, right? Do people know that? The president of Yale University.
Some of us know that.
His name is Soloway. But he's part of the Soloveitchik, and he knows he's part of the Soloveitchik family. And so my good friend, they were in Yale together and they're friendly. He told me now, just with everything going on, he's trying to very much, you know, do that. And my friend told Soloway that he quoted him the pasuk in Megillat Esther, in the real Megillat Esther, Umeyodea im la'ekazot, he got the machut. Maybe God put you as a friend of Yale for this moment to steer Yale, you know, to be a moral, clarity like Joe Biden is, you know, to be moral clear. But anyway, so where would you put the Torah? What section of the library would you put the Torah? History.
Wow. It's really debatable. Narrative, ethics, legal. Philosophy.
I'm sorry, Yocheved?
I'm saying it's debatable. On one hand, it has a legal aspect to it. On the other hand, there's narrative. There's also ethics. So it really doesn't fit one category.
I hope it's in nonfiction. That's the one thing I think we can all agree. It's in the nonfiction category, because there are people who... this isn't a joke. I mean, for us, we can laugh at that. But there are many people who... There's made-up stories by, you know, a bunch of people 3,000 years ago. And the truth of the matter, the Rambam sort of says that in certain... Not that it's fiction, but he says, you know, dreams, part of the Torah were dreams, didn't really happen. So so we first have to agree it's in the nonfiction, you know, so even that's not 1,000% clear. And then we got to go to, got to figure out it's history, it's law, it's philosophy. I don't know, poetry, maybe a little bit. Then why do I put the Torah in the book, in the poetry section? Because the Torah says it's poetry, right?
Shiva Hazot.
The Torah, the 613.
It's assumed,
but the Rambam assumes is the 613th mitzvah, right? In fact, it is Kvatem Kitu Lachem Et Hashira Hazot, write for you this song. Now, in the Pshat, it means Shirat Hazinu. That's right before that. There's a song, Hazinu Hashemayim Adabera. But in the Drash, which I guess could change, but in the Drash, the rabbis interpret that to mean the entire Torah is a Shira. And you have to write down, that's the mitzvah, to write down a Sefer Torah. So we'll get to why don't people do that anymore? So this is fascinating. Why? How many people here have commissioned the Sefer Torah? You don't have to raise your hand, because then I'll ask you for a donation.
Because now we have access.
You can afford to donate a Sefer Torah. You're giving $10,000 to Torah Motion, okay? So because the commission of Sefer Torah has got to be today, I don't know, $75,000. Expensive. So some people say that's why you don't have to spend more than a fifth of your income or asset, whatever, a fifth of something, income, assets on any mitzvah. So it's too expensive, people can't afford it. That's the technical reason, but that's not the reason I go by. The reason
we have access to all, today we have access to all kinds
right,
of
things. Just the mitzvah, the mitzvah doesn't apply anymore. Yeah, reform. The mitzvah doesn't, why doesn't the mitzvah apply? And teach it to the Jewish people. You know, for the first 2,000 years of Jewish history, 1,500 years, you were not allowed to write down the oral law. So the only mechanism, the only book you could use to teach the Torah was the Torah itself. But now that we have Mishnah and Talmud and Art Scroll and Koran and everything in between, so we can, we don't need a Torah. Who learns from a Sefer Torah? You know, anybody who takes out a Sefer Torah when they want to learn, we consider that disrespectful. It's disrespectful to go to the shul and take out a Sefer Torah. And the whole purpose of writing the mitzvah, of writing the, is to teach that the Torah tells you the reason. When the Torah tells you the reason doesn't apply. This is said by no less an authority than Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh. The Rosh is in the back of every Gemara, the leader, you know, of German Jewry in the 13th century. Then he moved to Spain when the Maharam of Rutenberg got arrested in 1286. The Rosh fled. I don't know if he quite, maybe he fled a little later. I don't know exactly when, but he becomes rabbi in Toledo, Spain, not Ohio, in 13, oh, I may remember Toledo, I don't know, Spain in 1302. And there's Ashkenazic rabbi in Sfar. He was the Gadol Ador. I mean, him and the Rashba. The Rashba sent the message to the Jews in Toledo. I know he's Ashkenazi. You know, this is Spain. It's not like today. Ashkenazi and Sfaradim, you know, married each other. Are you kidding? So, but he was such a great person. So the Rush quotes this, and it's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, and the Ramah accepts this opinion that the mitzvah no longer applies today. So I've said many, many times that I'm glad. Okay, so nobody commissioned a Sefer Torah? Okay, good. Because now I can see that I like to... Yes. Marty, you commissioned one?
No.
So wait 1 second, and then I'll let you ask. So now I won't insult anybody, God forbid. So I think it's one of the worst uses of money that you give. But person, I'm saying in a very strong language, I know. But if you have money to give to charity, one of the worst places you can do is write a Sefer Torah. I know they do it. The grandfather passed away. This one died. Well, there are 90% of Sefer Torah in the world are used on Simchas Torah alone to try to find people who'll carry a hakafah. You know, it's too many. It's too heavy. They don't want the hakafah. Most Sefer Torah are never used. And why somebody would spend, why we have Jews without an education, let's put a real Sefer Torah. Let's create people who know the Torah. That's what the Gemara says, how stupid people are. The Gemara in Makkah says, Kama tipshe inshi. That's the Gemara. I'm just a tipesh. That's the Yud of the Gemara. People are foolish. You know why they're foolish? What happens when, you know, they open up the Aron Kodesh and they take out the Sefer? Everybody jumps up from their seat. And what happens when a Torah scholar walks into the room? Everybody falls asleep. Who cares? Then the Gemara is saying, what idiots? The Torah scholar, that's the real Torah. That's why you rip Kriya when a Torah gets burned, God forbid. Just like you rip Kriya when a person dies, the person and the Torah, they're the same thing. It's one and the same. So this is a real Torah. This is just ink on parchment, like Rav Hananya ben Trajan said. You know, we see when they were burning him, the Romans, you know, the famous story. He said, what do you see? He says, the letters are flying heavenly. The parchment is being burned. So that's a real Sefer Torah. Let's invest in Jewish education. I don't understand why people give Sefer Torah. I mean, I understand the psychological, but whatever. So I'm sorry if you don't agree with me, that's the Seder. But that's what I feel. But I only say that because nobody here dedicated a Sefer Torah. If somebody did, God forbid, they mean well. They mean well. Not Chas V'Shalom. They're wonderful people. But it's just really, really dumb way to give your money. And you have to give your money smart. You don't have money. Yes, okay. Now, Marty, Chris.
You were talking a few minutes ago about when how you know the mitzvah applies. I think just last week there was I think it was in the Parshas here last week, the person said something about if a mitzvah has been fulfilled once, it doesn't have to be fulfilled again.
He was talking about a minhag. Yeah, there is an idea. It's very interesting. It's actually
what was he talking?
I think you're talking about Rabbi Taubes was shared last week on Baichi. I think if I remember correctly, he's talking about when things can change. It's actually, he didn't go into this part, but it's actually easier if we had a Sanhedrin. It's much easier to change a biblical law than a rabbinic law, because a minhag. Once something come established like this, matter of fact, this came up on my trip here in Israel. Just came up yesterday or something. Someone who's asking, he had a certain chumrah he was doing. Then he came to Israel and he wanted to know if he still had to do the chumrah. So the person asked him, were you doing the chumrah because you knew you didn't have to and you're being more strict? Or did you do it because you thought that was the law? So Rav Moshe has a tshuva about this. If you think it's the law, then you don't have to do it anymore. I thought the halakha said X. Now the halakha doesn't say X. I don't have to observe X. But if I know the halakha doesn't say X, but I want to be strict. I want to be strict. So I know I don't have to be. That's very hard. That's hatarat nidarim. You have nidin. And then you have rabbinic law. Also, once it spreads, it's actually harder to change. Because basically when you're changing the biblical laws, what you're saying is the rabbinic interpretation was incorrect. And if something is incorrect, they don't have to do it. When you have a rabbinic law, the rabbis know that you're allowed to eat chicken and milk and melt together. Everybody knows that. They just said, no, you can't do that because we're afraid. That is much, much harder to change. You need gadol b'chachmo u'b'minyan. You need a greater and a more greater quantity and greater quality in the court to change something which we assume we don't really have. So anyway, so it's very interesting that sometimes minhagim and rabbinic laws are harder to change than actual biblical laws. But let me, so I think that's what he was referring to. If you do the minhag once, three times, like people don't eat kibbutz on Pesach. And then they say they want to eat kibbutz on Pesach, because who wants to not eat half the food you can eat on Pesach? But so it depends. Why are they not eating kibbutz? If they think it's chametz and there was a safek chametz, today it's all different. We make it much different. Like maybe there was a legitimate fear 200 years ago. Today the fear of kibbutz is non-existent. And okay. But if you're doing it, you know you can eat it. But you have a minhag not to eat it. That's much harder to change. But anyways, let's get back to what the Torah is. Right?
Can I ask you something? Sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
I want people to interrupt me. I mean, you know, not always, but often.
Rabbi Sachs has a beautiful idea where he says there are textbooks and there are text people, where he talks about people who know a lot of Torah and that you should honor them by standing up for the text people, similar to the idea you were saying.
That's what the Gemara, he's basing on that Gemara in Makot, the end of
right.
Makot.
That's it. At the beginning of this war, they had asked women to light an extra candle on Erev Shabbos. So I've been doing that. Now, does that become something that I have to continue indefinitely?
I don't know. I'm not a posek here. So I think they would probably tell you, just have in mind, you don't do it indefinitely. So it's very interesting. I'm in Israel now. So I've been to five different shuls. I don't know exactly in the week that I've been here. Not one of them says Avinu Malkeinu. Never have I heard. My shul, they say Avinu Malkeinu Shachar Mincha. I already mentioned a couple of weeks ago, I'm against it. It takes away from its meaning. And here I am in Israel. Nobody says Avinu Malkeinu. I mean, I haven't been to any minyan that says it yet. They make one Mishnah Berurah at the end. They made, on Thursday morning, in the Pinsker building, they made, a Mishnah Berurah for the hostages. Okay. Very nice. They didn't do it the other days. I think just when they're doing laning, whatever, it's different. Because once you do something routine, then it becomes part of the davening. Our minhag. I have a minhag to say Avinu Malkeinu. What do you have a minhag to say Avinu Malkeinu? Like that's, so I don't know. But that's what you need leaders for. But yeah, if you're doing one thing, it should be for the thing. I don't know. What's the connection between lighting an extra candle?
There are some women who can't light.
Women who can't light because they're in the army.
Either that or because they're chatufim.
Okay, they're chatufim. Okay, in the army. Okay, all right. Okay, it's interesting. It's a nice thing, I guess. I just don't, you know. Okay, All right. What thing? Listen, the classical thing, tshuva, tefillah, utstaka. I think whatever, tzedakah is always good and tshuva is always good. And tefillah is good. I can say the problem is we work on the quantity of tefillah and we should way work on the quality. We have way too much quantity of davening. The quantity of davening is way too long. That's why on Yom Kippur, in the time of the Mishnah, the girls and guys could go dancing in the fields and go on dates and shidduchim. But today, you get a 45-minute break, depending on what shul you do. You go to YU, they start at 7 in the morning and have a 30-minute break. You go to any yeshiva, who has a break? Got piyutim, more piyutim, this, and already the art school puts, a lot in the back, for those who want to say more. Davening is way too long. And people can't take it. So they mumble. And the davening has to finish in X hours, davening over 2 hours in Shabbos morning today. Who has time for more than a 2 hour davening? And, we should improve the quality, not the quantity. We should daven less. Many times we said, I guess we're back to our Siddur class now. In the first, like Siman in the Shulchan Aruch, Tov Ma'at Im Kavana Mehar Be Below Kavana. It's better to daven. You don't have to say Psukit Azim every day. It's okay. You can say part of it, say Ashrei, and that's it. And the next day say hallelujah. You don't. It's about to say, oh my gosh, well, who is this guy? But people were. That's part of the problem of the printed word. That's part of the printing press. When an art stroll, the rabbi's dead on arrival. The rabbi can say whatever he wants. The guy who can't read Hebrew goes to the rabbi. But in art scroll, it says we do this. That's it. The rabbi's finished. Okay, it's not going to go against art scroll, he'll lose his job. But so it's whatever. I think out of the box, or I don't know what to say. But so I think I'm not into saying extra tilim. I'm saying, I mentioned last week, Selam not Seach Mizmor le David out loud, pasuk by pasuk, instead of adding in an extra shir hamalot that everybody's in a hurry and they're taking off their tefillin while they're saying it, at least in the men's section, so that's not so respectful. But the people are in a hurry. So just whatever. Okay. Anyways, back here. So, but let's get back to, I said what section we're putting in the Torah, right? We're talking in theory about the 613 mitzvot, which may be the definition of Talmud Torah. And, we're explaining now that what type of book is the Torah? So it's an elaborate. So we say it may belong in the poetry section because it says Hashirazot. So we explain why Shira, which is the mitzvah to write the whole Torah, why we don't do that mitzvah anymore, fine. But what does it mean, Shira? So there are really two different explanations given by two brothers-in-law, by Dinitziv and the Aruch HaShulchan, Yechiel Michal Epstein. They were brothers-in-law, and then father-in-law and son-in-law, right? Everybody knows that, right? The Dinitziv married his niece, who was 36 years his junior after his wife died. And they thought she was nuts. And he said, no, I want to marry the Netziv. It was a big honor. He was 70 or something. And she was like 35 or 34. Exactly. And so the Aruch HaShulchan, who was his brother-in-law, became his father-in-law. It's a pretty cool trick. I'm going to try that one day. Right. And that son, of course, they had a very famous son, Rav Meir Bar Ilan. Naftali Svita Berlin, Rav Meir Bar Ilan, he was a big Zionist, as was his father. His father died in 1893. It's pre-Herzl, but he supported the nascent Zionist movement. So his son was a real member of the Zionist movement. And of course, he Hebrewized his name to Bar Ilan, and Bar Ilan University is named for Rav Meir Bar Ilan. Then it seems that's one branch of the family. The other branch, of course, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik married the granddaughter of the Netziv. Rav Chaim, and as did Shaul Lieberman. Shaul Lieberman married one of the granddaughters of the Netziv. She was the principal of Shulamis. If anybody went to Shulamis, so Shaul Lieberman's wife. Whatever, who Mark gave his 18 classes on. Anyways, lots of, money marries money, rabbis marry rabbis. That's the way it goes. That's the way life works. There used to be rabbis married money. That was the old way. That's how rabbis could become rabbis, because some rich father-in-law would want a Talmud Chacham, you know, son, but it takes a long time to become a Talmud Chacham. So the rich father-in-law would get. So it used to be money married rabbis and rabbis married rabbis and money married rabbis, whatever. That's how life works. Everybody knows that. That's the social economics of life. Anyway, so these two brothers-in-law, father-in-law, son-in-law. So the Netziv has, discuss this on because it's so beautiful, so beautiful. In his introduction to Chumash, says why the Torah is a poem, and he explains that the Torah is a poem. Poetry, we reading between the lines is the words almost are meaningless in a poem. It's reading between the lines. When you have a poem, you write weird words because you want to make it rhyme. So you write things in sort of weird ways to allude. The Torah often writes, you know, an extra word. It's sort of a little jungled, jumbled, so wants to hint to something. The essay, great poetry has to be interpreted, and interpretations change over time. They stand the test of that. It's exactly what the Torah is. And it could be like an English literature, teacher of English literature, and explaining what poetry is. And that's exactly how the Torah works. And you know what? He says it's pretty boring if you don't know what you're doing. Like, because poetry, you read it. Well, what does this mean? This is crazy. Yeah, the more you study it, you see the beauty and you uncover. And every generation always finds a new meaning in great poetry. So that's why the Torah belongs in the poetry section, not just Az Yashir Moshe and Hazinu. The entire Torah is poetry. His brother-in-law, the Aruch HaShulchan, explains Shira, not as a poem, but the way we would probably explain it, as a song. And he said the Torah is a symphony. And in a symphony, everybody has a part to play. And what are the four things in the symphony? Percussions, I don't remember anymore. And somebody knows music, please tell me. The different,
wind, strings.
Wind, string. Thank you very much. Right. So everybody, and sometimes the drummer or the cymbals, they just do one bang. But the whole song would be different if not for that one click. You know, you got to know exactly. And he said the Torah is a shira. It's a symphony of people coming together with different voices, and everybody adds more. Yeah, you know, so it's a beautiful. So the Torah belongs on the top 100 and the top 10 charts, you know, of the music. And it belongs in the poetry section, the history section, the law section. But why are we mentioning all this? Maybe it's interesting because the real section it belongs in, and that's how the Balatanya, that's what's for. Rav Schechter told us, you know, when I was in Shir, he said the real explanation of what the Torah is, and based on the Ramban, I believe, the Torah is a description of God. The otiyot of the Torah are the description of God. So I don't exactly know what this means. Obviously, you need some Kabbalistic leanings to know what this means. But the Torah describes God, and that's how we explain why you can have mitzvot in the Torah that never have been and never will be, right? The classic thing I'm sure many of you were taught, that there was never an Ir Nidachet. There was never a city full of idolaters that's so bad they had to wipe out the whole city. There was never a Ben Sora or Merer. There was never a rebellious child. So the Torah says, why do you need it? Like, so the Torah says, Drush Ukabaskar. In other words, you're right, it's never happened, but we'll learn it and we'll get the reward for learning for Talmud Torah. So the people, that's ridiculous. Rosh Kabbalah means it's something in theory. So I learn about the laws of Truma in the 1600s or whatever. Even it'll apply one day. I learn about Binyan Beit HaMikdash or Korbanos. It's not that I can't do it for technical reasons, but to have something in the Torah that will never ever apply just so we get the reward for learning, well, that doesn't make any sense. So that is, there's so much else to learn. No, but there's an aspect of God within Ben Soromer. God has this vengeful side to him, so to speak, where you're going to wipe out the whole city. You know, genocide. I mean, I don't want to say it, you know, but that's the Ir Nidachet. We're going to wipe out the whole city. You know, although they cleared it out to people who didn't do a Avodah Zarah, it's not pure, just like Amalek. You don't wipe out Amalek. The Rambam writes that you have to give Amalek, you have to offer them peace, and you have to let them escape. It's only if they decide not to, then you have to wipe them out. But it's not that we go and wipe them out. Even Amalek, the archenemy of the Jewish people. Anyway, so the 613 mitzvot is many ways a description of who God is, whatever that means exactly. But every mitzvah, which of course we on a very basic level, we understand it. What is the Torah? The Torah is God's command to us. So the Torah is basically describing what God wants. So the Torah, that's what the Torah is. Okay. Okay. So now
God's values. It describes God's values. What God values.
But the age may more describes, you know, it's an aspect of God, just like, you know, like the 365 negative commandments. So, you know, according to the days of the year, right? That 365 days in a year, that's why they're 365 negative. That's what the Gemara says. So there is an idea that every day is a different aspect of mitzvah. I've never learned this, and I don't quite understand it, because a Hebrew year, a Jewish year never has 365 days, only a solar year. So you can say July 4th, but I do know that this Zohar that says there, which I haven't learned inside because I'm still under 40 intellectually. The Zohar says the 365 mitzvot. So they start telling you which day, which mitzvah. So Tisha B'Av is Gita Nasha. The mitzvah for Tisha B'Av is Gita. I don't exactly know if they have the whole list. I'm not sure. But that I remember hearing many years ago, that Tisha B'Av corresponds to the mitzvah of Gid HaNasheh. And the 248 relate to the limbs of our body. So if the mitzvot are, you know, our heart and our fingernail and whatever finger, and we know that there are vital organs and less vital organs. You can live without an arm. You can't live without a heart. So there are 248 mitzvot. Some are vital. Brit Milah, Korban Pesach. Some mitzvot. Shabbat, these are vital mitzvot, whatever. And other mitzvot are not so vital. It's nice. It's not the end of the world. You don't put on tefillin. I'm not telling anybody not to put on tefillin, but it's like the world doesn't come to an end. The Gemara does like tefillin a lot. But,
do you think it's possible that the drush v'kabel tzchar, the pshat is tzchar of drush is itself.
Yeah, it's schar mitzvah mitzvah, but the assumption is, listen, Rav Shakti say this all the time. He more than other people, much more than the Brisker style. The goal of learning is halacha. That's, if you know, Rav Shachter, that's him. We learn to know to Paskin Halacha. That's the only reason we learn. Who cares that we learn, like, to learn all the stuff without which is sort of how the Rambam decided to learn. That's what the Rambam. You don't need all this Gemara. Okay, he's not saying you shouldn't learn Gemara, but the purpose of learning is, you know, to learn what the Halacha is. And the Brisker Derech totally revamped that. That was a revolution. And I don't have to tell you, even though the Brisker Derech conquered the world, many of the Gedolim at the time hated it. They thought it was terrible. They thought this was the Ritva's famously called it chemistry. And he wasn't, because he, you know, believed in getting a PhD in chemistry. That wasn't the compliment. And, Rav Chaim was a chemist. He takes the parts and he puts them together, analyzes it. That's not Torah. That's not the traditional way of learning Torah. And therefore, briskers can't paskin. Everybody knows that. Briskers don't know how to paskin, because they can always see two sides of every issue and two ways to look at a chakir. Should it be like this or should it be like that? If it's like this, it's like this. Okay, so which is it? You know, like, so that's a real issue. And that's why the great paskin never came from the world of brisk, because they don't know how to paskin. And whatever, that's just the way. Yocheved, I see you want to say something, or you don't.
Oh, well, I'm just going back to the idea of this, of the text people. So when Rav Unterman came, I think in the 40s, he kissed Rav Soloveitchik, and then he explained to Rabbi Lam that how could you not kiss a Torah?
So yeah, okay. Yeah. This right. In the Spartak world, I heard Rav Avadya Yosef speak twice in my life. I went when I was in yeshiva, so I went to hear him once, and he spoke every Sunday. I'm talking now in the 80s, early 80s, probably 1980. And I remember the first time I heard him speak, he spoke on the minhag not to get married in Sfira, and he thought that wasn't such a good minhag. Yeah, you can violate that minhag. What do you mean, not get married in Sfira? Getting married is like the most important mitzvah. When you're not going to get married in Sfira? It's time to get married. Get married whenever you can. Get married this quarter. So you get married in Sfira. I don't know that he was saying it halacha, the mitzvah, but that's, I remember I was, you know, 18 years old. And I remember Rabbi Zeb, he was very sort of critical of this minhag. It's a minhag, but it's a difficult minhag. I don't remember the whole thing. But of course, what else I remember is everybody kissed him. Kissed his hand when he came in the Spartan world. They kissed their rabbis. In the Ashkenazic world, they spit on their rabbi. Oh, no, I shouldn't say that. But in certain rabbis, it depends. There is a problem of, I mean, on the one hand, we have too much respect for rabbis, like too much deference, and the rabbi says something nobody questions. That's not good. It was never good. And that's not, but on the other hand, they don't really listen to, I mean, I don't have to, whatever, and get into it so much, but believe me, if the rabbis say something and the balabatim don't like it, they don't listen. When the aguda try to bring in the sumptuary laws, whatever that word is, sumptuary laws, that you can't spend too much money on a wedding, so people, they laughed at them, and they went apart, because the rich people weren't going to have the rabbi tell them how much money they can spend on a wedding. And they made exceptions. Well, this and that, once you make exceptions, that's it, you're finished. The Ger is the only community that successfully does that. That the Ger Rebbe say, no, he can't spend more money. They follow him, from what I understand. But, you know, the people, they don't care. They listen to the rabbis. When the rabbis say something, they agree with. It's like Mark Shapiro would always say, I don't know who's the Gadol HaDor today in the Haredi world. I don't even know. It's after Rav Steinman and Rav Eliyashiv, Chaim Kanievsky. I don't know. Who's next? I really don't know. I should know, but whoever it is, if he were to get up tomorrow and say, we should say hello on Yom HaTzmut, they wouldn't say hello on Yom HaTzmut. They would throw him out. They'd say he's not from our world anymore. He left. In other words, they wouldn't say, well, he's a Gadol B'Yisrael, and maybe because of what's going on in Israel, we should be thankful we have a state of Israel to defend us. They would say he lost his marbles, and we're going to find a new Gadol. So whatever, there's not so much. The respect is skin deep. In the Sephardic world, I think there's much more respect. Anyways, that's how I see it. Maybe I'm totally wrong, and maybe your experiences are different. But anyways, every mitzvah in the Torah represents an aspect of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, what I want to do, we don't have that much time left, and I have to wait till my next trip to continue, I hope. But I really wanted to cover the different levels of Torah. Where I said, I think I wrote that, what are the 600 mitzvot and the thousands of non-mitzvot, like not the cook on Shabbos.
Rabbi Kelman?
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but did you explain what the Aruch HaShulchan said? Maybe you didn't, I missed it.
Yes, the Aruch HaShulchan, the symphony, music.
Oh, the symphony, right. Okay. Sorry about that.
Shira is music, not poetry. Then it seems it's a little bit more radical. It's very beautiful. It's also more famous because it's in his introduction to the Torah, his Kidmat HaEmek, and it's in the introduction to his commentary on the Torah. The Aruch HaShulchan, it's in like a really weird place, and it's sort of in the middle of his introduction to Choshen Mishpat. The Aruch HaShulchan was halachist. He was the wrote the Aruch HaShulchan. He's a great halachist. And so he must have written Yehoshua Mishpat first, not Aruch Chaim. And he writes a 3-page introduction, and sort of like in the middle somewhere, he throws in this line about, like, if you're not learning, like, it's much harder to find. It's just not as well known, but it's more in keeping with what I think.
So what does he mean by symphony? The different voices of Klal Yisrael?
Yeah. Every Jew contributes in a different way. Everybody.
Okay. Not interpretation.
I assume interpretation too. We have Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elohim. He doesn't, I can look it up again. He doesn't explain himself at great length. It's just a sort of a throwaway sentence. You know, the Torah's Eshira, many voices come together, just like in a symphony. I don't know if he uses that word, but he does use something. It's like music, and every instrument has their own beat. And some only play a little bit. Some are playing all the time, but it's the harmony. What makes the Torah great is the many voices. And that's, I've said many times, I'm here on a trip. I this is more voices than many people would like, but I'm on a trip with, it was an Orthodox conservative and Reform rabbis, you know, so whatever, there is what to learn even from rabbis or from people. For Halo made me call Adam. When Ben Zoma says, Halo Ezechon made me call Adam. We can learn from other people, and even people we don't see together ideologically, right? In most conservative reform schools, people talk less than in Orthodox schools, in many, not always. That's something we can learn from them. There are all kinds of things we can learn. We can learn from everybody. So, anyways, that's just, but that's the way he explains it. But he's talking, of course, obviously within a traditional framework, but everybody has their role to add. Okay, what I'll very briefly do, because we do have to end soon, is I'll mention sort of the different sort of levels of Torah mitzvot. So we explained already, the 613 mitzvah means it's written in the Torah. That's how the Rambam explains it. If it's not a verse in the Torah, lo tavashu di b'chalevimo, whatever that means, lo tirtzach, lo tignov, you know, zachor et yom ha-shabbat l'kodesho, that's mitzvah. The interpretation of that mitzvah can explain. But there is going to be a mitzvah that can never change to remember our Shabbat. So that's the highest level, Torah Shebichtav. Then we have our drashot, that we talk about, the interpretations of Torah, which are considered biblical law, but they're not considered part of the 613 mitzvot. And then we have, I think, even a little bit above the drashot, are we call halacha l'moshe Sinai. That's we don't really have time to get into that. These it's generally understood to mean laws that were dictated to Moshe at Mount Sinai, have zero biblical references. You can read the Torah with all the poetry in the world and all the between the lines in the world, and you'll never know that tefillin should be black. There's nothing in the Torah that hints that tefillin should be black. That's a halacha l'moshe misina. That's a law given to Moshe at Mount Sinai. That's why you've never seen a blue pair of tefillin. We would assume you did not fulfill the mitzvah, your tefillin are blue. Interestingly enough, who cares? Right? Our tzitzis are blue, you know, chelet, whatever. So we have halacha, the Moshe Sinai. It's a slightly lower status than something written in the Torah itself. But those are the three types of biblical law, that Torah Shebichtav, halacha, the Moshe Sinai, and our drashot. Then we have this in-between category, Divrei Kabbalah. We assume reading the Megillah on Purim is Divrei Kabbalah. Divrei Kabbalah is generally, all these three require, of course, more discussion, but just as a very brief overview, Divrei Kabbalah, we assume, are things written in Tanakh, but not in the Torah itself. For example, Kavod and Onek Shabbos is based on a pasuk in Yeshayahu. Chapter 55, 56. You should walk differently, you should talk differently, you should dress differently on Shabbat. So that's the right from a verse in Yishayahu. So it's not the oraita, it's not biblical in the classical sense. It's not rabbinic either. It's from a prophet. So that's what we call Divrei Kabbalah. So we assume Megillat Esther, reading Megillat Esther is Divrei Kabbalah, sort of words of that's a higher status than a rabbinic law. And then we have Takanot, where just rabbis making.
Did I not put it in the right one? I thought I put it in the slate.
You can't marry.
$500.
Hold on. I assume you're not asking me a question. So if you mute yourself, please, if you don't mind. And then you have.
Maybe something fell off. Can't marry
more than one wife. Why don't I? Okay, give me 1 second. Okay. And then we have our gzeirot. You can't do A because it might lead to B. You can't eat chicken and milk because you may accidentally eat meat and milk. But it's just A may lead to B. Really, it's allowed. And then the lowest form of anything is minhag. But that people take minhag very seriously. Okay, so we'll have to discuss that, please God, and some other time. But just let's quickly review. We went over the whole notion of the 613 mitzvot, where it cuts, we don't have an agreed upon list. And the Bahag, the Ramban, and the Megillat Esther is always defending the Rambam. And therefore he says living in Israel, not only is it not a mitzvah, it's a prohibition to set up a community. Of course, nobody accepts that outside of the Satmar world. But it's not that they're based on nothing. It's based on a Gemara in Ksubas that people followed. So the Zionists changed the way we look at the return to Zion for good reason. But we don't have. But what the mitzvot are, the mitzvot are very important because that can't change. Everything else can change. Rabbinic interpretation can change. Everything else can change. But not the Taryak mitzvot that are based on verses in the Torah. The interpretation of those verses could change. We can't change them. Yudalei Maimon tried to set up a Sanhedrin. Rav Yaakov Beirav gave smicha to Rav Yosef Karo. But these things did not last. And the attempts of Yehuda Leib Maimon went nowhere for obvious reasons. These things are, I don't know how we're going to change that, but change is very slow, especially radical change like that. Except that we spoke of why there's no mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah. Where do we put the Sefer Torah? History, law, philosophy. It's all a true, but also poetry and song. We went through that, and then we just started to discuss very briefly the different levels of mitzvah in the Torah. And it's important to know, is something a rabbinic mitzvah, is something only a minhag, is something the Divrei Kabbalah, because it has great importance halachically for extenuating circumstances, when you can ignore it, what do you do there. It's very important to know. It's not just all the law is the same. No, it's not the same. It's very different. Okay, let me just...
What's the difference between takanot and gzeirot, Rabbi Kalman?
Takanot are positive things. The rabbis sort of invent a new law. They say a takana is you can't marry more than one wife. The Torah allows you to marry more than one wife.
Okay.
Right, you can't... the cherem, the, right, a gzeira is don't do A lest it come to B. You have a prohibition Torah, so I'm not allowed to climb a tree. Not that I'm not allowed to climb a tree. Well, I'm afraid if I climb a tree, I'll break a branch. And breaking a branch is a biblical prohibition. I can't eat chicken and milk. 80%, I don't know what the number is, a very high percentage of things we do not do on Shabbat are because we're afraid it's going to lead to our
like Torah. A fence.
Okay.
Isn't there a concept that you're not supposed to learn
You froze.
From Nach.
I'm sorry, you froze.
Isn't there a halacha that you can't learn out from Navi, a halacha?
Not exactly.
My son mentioned, I'm not a London, but my son mentioned this one.
Yeah, we do learn anything from the Navi. Yeah, we do learn a lot of things from Navi. It doesn't, that's much more complicated, and we don't have time now to get into it. I really have to go, and it's almost Shabbos where I am. So, you know, just let me very quickly look at the questions. Yeah, the scholar is the real Torah. That's why today there's no mitzvah to write the Sefer Torah, because we have other books. Rambam's reasons give an introduction. Must say avot simon levanim. We learn from the actions of our forefathers. Absolutely. Oh, somebody from Yerushalayim was on today. Very nice. Rav Moshe Sternbach is the gadol now in Eretz Yisrael. That's interesting, because I think he lived in South Africa for a while. Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky in America. Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay. Discuss how this led the Karaites. Okay. That's a whole lot. We had a series on the Karaites. Daniel Lasker. We have it on the Torah Motion Archives. We gave it fascinating. Karaite halacha. It's really fascinating. I didn't become a Karaite. And we shouldn't become Karaites, but it was really, they're not some idiots who just said this. There's a whole philosophy behind Karaism, and it's very interesting. And they used to be big, very big at one time. Raul Lieberman knew all the Bavli Yerushalmi. Yeah, Shaul Lieberman also knew. You want to say he knew the Yerushalmi too? That could be. Some say he was the greatest Baki in that generation in terms of knowledge, pure knowledge, not necessarily an analysis like Rav Soloveitchik, but some say Shaul Lieberman was the greatest Baki from that whole, the Rav Aaron Kotler, Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, Rav Ruderman, that whole generation of Gedolim who came to America, that he was perhaps the greatest Baki of them all. But anyways, okay, I want to wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. And from
Shabbat Shalom, stay safe.
Peace and good news. And people are strong here, but they need to be stronger and more peaceful. And we should hear good things. And please God, next week we'll be back to our regular time.
How much longer are you going to be there?
Leaving Sunday morning. So not very long. It's a quick visit.
And when did you arrive?
Monday night. That's a quick visit. And it's a long flight because there are no direct flights from Canada now. You have to fly. So we flew via London. You have to fly either via America, because LL stopped flying a few years ago and Air Canada stopped flying with the war. So there are no direct flights from Canada to Israel. So, okay. Anyways, okay. I want to wish everybody a
thank you.
Shabbat Shalom. Be well. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.